list from there. This is Barry Tyker. I am with Mrs. Gertrude Wilson again at her home. Today is January 17th, 1990. And we're going to continue the discussion we started last week, and I think we probably will have a few more sessions in the future. Mrs. Wilson was just telling me about life in Madison back when there were windmills in every house, except for whose house?
Richard T. Ely.
And what did he have?
Gasoline pump.
Why did he have that, do you know?
I don't know. He was different from the rest of us. He came from Johns Hopkins.
Were they more expensive?
I don't know why. Also, Mrs. Ely, Anna Mason Ely, was from Virginia, and they had an enormous house in which Dr. Barash now lives, and a huge house. His secretary, Dr. Ely's secretary, always lived in the house. And Mrs. Ely told my mother, she said, you know, I've got to have servants always. And so I take roomers.
Oh. So the roomers.
So I can have servants.
Part of their job as a roomer is to wash the dishes or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very clever.
No. She took roomers, but they paid money so that she could have servants.
Oh, so she could have servants
besides.
Oh, okay. I thought she used roomers as servants.
No.
A very ignorant question from a young upstart here. What exactly did the windmills all do?
Well, we had a well, an artesian well, and the windmill pumped, and we also had a cistern, and we had a grease trap, and we had a cesspool. The windmill pumped the water into an enormous tank in the third floor of our house. Way up high, you see. In a huge tank. The windmill pumped the water. It's the only way you had of getting water. And the windmill would go when the wind blew. When the wind didn't blow, it didn't go.
What, could you put a year on this approximate?
Oh yes, this was probably about, let's see, 1895. I was born in 1898. Probably, well, it was as soon as we built the house. The windmill was there. Wait, will you get that tin box?
Okay, I'm going to turn this off for one second. We've looked through the tin box and we found the statement of the cost of the residence built for Amos Knowlton.
Amos Arnold Knowlton.
Just for the record, it's so very interesting. Plastering cost $241. Heating and tin work $296. Mason $500. Plumbing and drainage $363. Carpenter work $2,283. Painting and glazing $500. Well $147.04. And the windmill and pump, this is what we were looking for, was $110. The electric wiring $38.85. The hardware $108. The mantle, $34.77, and the architect's fees, $221. The total, $4,842.66. And they also have a few extras listed at the
bottom. It wasn't added right, and I think they changed it.
And that was in what year now?
1895.
When did the windmills disappear?
I can't tell you that.
Okay.
Probably when electricity came, probably. You see, Mother cleaned 17 kerosene lamps every morning.
Oh, jeez. So your houses were lit by kerosene, obviously.
Yes.
By kerosene lamps. Question on the windmill and the water. How did the water taste? Was it good well water?
Oh, water was a wonderful artesian well water. Wonderful water.
You don't happen to remember how deep the wells were, do you?
Probably. I know a cat fell in one time. I don't know.
Okay.
Probably about 20 feet.
Okay. I'm going to ask some questions that probably aren't answerable, but there's a darn, there's, I have such a sort
now, of... Now, the cistern, collected soft water and was had a big round stone cover about this big around and about this thick. So it was something to lift.
Mm-hmm.
That was the cistern. And you see the pump was must have been connected to the cistern.
Yeah, I would suspect so.
And because that's the way we got soft water, and we also collected rainwater.
And you used the soft water for?
Washing our hair.
Washing your hair.
And washing my dog.
The dog you showed me the picture of earlier.
Oh, beautiful dog.
Mrs. Wilson showed me some photographs before we turned on the tape recorder. One taken with her brownie on a frost morning, frost-filled morning of Professor Ely walking down the street toward his office, I suspect. And it's a wonderful, wonderful shot. Now, you also talked a little bit about, before we turned on the tape, about the lamps on the street.
Yes, those were, the man would come up from the city, downtown. He'd lower the thing and replace the sticks of carbon on the corner of what is now Kendall and Adams Avenue. It used to be called Adams, on the corner of Adams Avenue and North Prospect, and replace the carbon and then pull it up again.
What kind of a light did that provide? Do you remember? Was it a pretty good one?
Pretty good, but not like...
Not like
that. Not what we would call adequate today.
What about the sidewalks?
You know, sidewalks were wooden. And I have some wonderful pictures, one of the corner where they're just laying the sidewalk. When we moved out there, there were no sidewalks.
And what were
this was before I was born, you see.
And the streets were mainly
were dirt.
Dirt. And
mud.
What kind of transportation? Who used the streets?
You mean
like horses and
well, horses. That was the only way.
And you had
or you walked and you walked on before the sidewalks. You just walked.
Got a little muddy in spring, I would
say. Oh yes. Mud would get up as far as the hub of a wheel of a wagon.
Yeah, I suspect a lot of people needed pushing. Now, did they have the horse cars from downtown?
Yes,
come out this way?
I do. I have some pictures to show you.
Okay, we'll look at
another
those
time.
Okay.
Horses. The streetcars were pulled by horses, and went only as far as Breeze Terrace and University Avenue.
And from there you had to walk.
From there you walked.
So and what was essentially beyond Breeze Terrace?
Well, that was Camp Randall, of course, was where down here.
But there weren't many houses beyond that, were there?
Well, there were no houses. There was nothing. There was a log cabin on Lathrop Street in the block between Kendall Avenue and Summit on Lathrop Street, a log cabin. A Mr. Backus lived there alone, and we got our eggs from him.
He would raise chickens out there?
Yes. That is, I told you where it was. Where it was.
Now, before the we started the tape, you also told me some interesting information about Frederick Jackson Turner. Why don't we go back over that? About how he came?
How he came?
Homer Haskins?
Oh, yes. Well, here's a whole... Have you seen this?
Yes, I have.
You have. You've seen
the book
that
on Frederick Jackson Turner.
Yes.
Martin Ray.
<Rich.
He's coughs> edited.
His wife was extremely social. He was a scholar. She was interested in a place in society. And when the call came to go to Harvard, he was loath to go very much. After all, he was from Portage. He was a Wisconsin man. And he went, I think, to please her. I can't tell you exactly what year, but since I had my wedding breakfast there in their home, they lived at 7 Phillips Place in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we lived at number 3 Phillips Place. And he was well established then, there, of course. So it was before 1923. And it must have been, I think he probably left around, around 1910. I'm not sure.
I can check on that.
Mm-hmm, you can find that out. He was a perfectly lovely person. He was so gentle and sweet. They had a player piano, electric player piano in Cambridge. And we had their house one summer when they went to Hancock Point, Maine, which they did every single summer while he was at Harvard. They had a summer home at Hancock Point, Maine. And my sister Margaret went with him one summer as his secretary.
And how did you enjoy living in his house for that summer? Was it a nice?
No, I didn't enjoy it because I don't like to live in other people's houses. I'm afraid of something happening to it.
Now, you just described a very pleasant person. I'd like to go back over something we said last time. You mentioned the incident with Mary Frank with the birds
outside
of
her
house. When did that occur?
I think the Franks, Glenn Frank, I think they were the first people to live in this in this what I call the president's house. That's why I was so confused about Dr. Burge, because he never lived there.
Yeah.
And I remember people saying when he became president, well, he's only got a couple of doors to move, shouldn't be anything great. You see, this was because it was Langdon Street. But I didn't know that where President Van Hise lived was ever called the president's house.
So the Franks were the first to occupy it.
I think the Franks were the first.
Did this incident occur early on?
Yes. She was an objectionable person. Nobody liked her.
Did it cause an incident at all?
Well, it caused plenty of dislike because we like birds.
I mean, did it make the Daily Cardinal or the newspapers or anything like that?
Probably.
Yeah. And that would have been in the first couple months that they were...
I don't know when, but it was when they first arrived.
Okay.
She made no effort to endear herself to the faculty or to the neighborhood.
Well, shooting the birds, for those of you who haven't listened to the first tape, the birds disturbed her in the morning?
The birds woke her up.
So who did she get to come?
The university police to come out and shoot them.
That's not a real great way.
It's not a way to win friends.
Okay, I'm going to turn it off for a second. Over the course of the last week, Mrs. Wilson very kindly made a list of people that she has remembrances of and would like discussing. We're just going to do it in alphabetical order, so we're going to be jumping around in time here, but so be it. The first name on the list is, of course, an A, and his name is Charles Kendall Adams.
Well, Charles Kendall Adams was president. His wife referred to my mother as the Madonna Knowlton, and I have a lovely card from her written to my mother when the Adamses were in Germany. She had very poor health.
Now, the Madonna was simply a reference to her?
To my mother. My mother was a very beautiful woman, and she had 5 children and looked after them. And Charles Kendall Adams, was very much respected and loved as a president.
Any idea where the Kendall came from?
No. But of course, Kendall Avenue was first, as I've told you, Adams Avenue.
Right. And there is another Adams right around.
Yeah, Adams Street right, is over here.
Agard.
Oh, Walter Agard came here from in the experimental college from Amherst. We always called him Ray. I don't know why. Ray Agard in classics. And I have to be careful because things I say to you I don't want.
Okay, well, if you want me to, do you want me to turn off this machine?
Yes.
Okay, we're back on. Arthur Altmaier.
Well, Arthur Altmaier was here in the not long, but he was the author, the founder of Social Security. And lived. Now, this is much later, of course.
Yeah, this is, we're talking about
the, yes, great. I think, well, what connection he had with the university, I can't say. It was probably in the economics department.
I would suspect so. I wonder if he worked with,
John R. Commons?
No, the person in the dormitory was Witte.
Ed Witte?
Yeah, because Witte was involved in, yes, Social Security, oh, yes, also.
He probably did.
A name very familiar to all of us, Babcock.
Oh, yes. Well, when mother and father came here in 1890 and lived on Lake Street, just back of where Brown's bookstore is, the Babcocks lived behind them. So their backyards were together. And the Babcocks had a beautiful garden.
What kind of people were the couple?
Very nice, very lovely people.
Mrs. Babcock?
Yes, very lovely people. And of course, he was a great man.
What about his, the Babcock ice cream? And
Babcock Hall?
Babcock Hall. When was he involved in the first?
I don't think he had anything to do with that.
The ice cream?
But their ice cream and their butter is best there is.
No argument for me. Mr. Burge, President Burge.
Dean Burge.
Dean
Burge, E.A. Burge. He had a son and he had a daughter. His son, Ted Burge, was a friend of my brother, Philip. And they had many good times together. Nan Burge, I presume her name was Anna, mm-hmm, but she was called Nan, mm-hmm, took over as hostess when Mrs. Burge died, and I can't tell you when. Mm-hmm. But the Burges were in Leipzig prior, Leipzig, Germany, when my father and mother arrived in Leipzig, and that's when they became close friends.
Now, you mentioned that last time, and I didn't pursue it as much as I would have liked. Germany was obviously where many people went.
Oh, Germany was the center of learning.
What were the
people
main...
went to Germany to get a PhD because it wasn't granted in the United States.
Was Leipzig one of the real...
In Leipzig and Heidelberg.
Were the two
great centers. And the Burges were already there.
And he was studying for his... Was it called a PhD? Doctorate?
I suppose so.
What about Bruns?
Oh, Frederick Bruns was a professor of German. He was a friend of ours, and he was a very nice man. Lived up here near what is now called Virginia Terrace, mm-hmm, later on.
Did he study in Leipzig?
I don't know, but he was here in the university, but I can't tell you his background, okay, prior to that.
Tell me a little bit about the German department.
German department, Mr. Professor Bruns, Professor Hohlfeld, I can't tell you very much about it, except Professor Hohlfeld, who had two sons, Karl Hohlfeld, and another son. One was drowned in the Amazon River,
oh,
on an expedition.
Let's skip to Hohlfeld. I see you have his name on the list while we're in the German department here. What kind of a man was he?
Professor Hohlfeld?
Mm-hmm.
He was a very courtly European gentleman.
He was sort of the dean of the German department.
Yes.
The chairman,
yes,
I believe, for many, many years.
Very scholarly, very tall. They lived over on what we now call Lathrop Street. For a long time.
What about what happened to him during the World War One?
World War One was disastrous for the German department. It also was, in my way, the end of the Age of Innocence of the university. World War One just created a great deal of bitterness and a great deal of hard feeling in the university. People who had been friends were no longer friends.
Now, you mentioned a friend of yours, something like Reichenfeld or something like that, who went down to Illinois, left here.
Oh, Rittinghouse. Rittinghouse.
And he committed suicide
Yes, he committed suicide in Austin, Texas.
Can you, Texas, that was it, can you remember any other specific incidents directed against people like Holfeld or Bruns here on campus that...
That involved the governor, too, Governor La Follette. The first governor, the old man, I mean.
Right.
Old Fighting Bob La Follette.
How did it involve him?
I want to be sure that I'm right about this. I know there was a petition signed. Mm-hmm. And my friend Isabel La Follette never forgave the Burges because Dean Burge signed the petition. Mm-hmm. And it was something that was to the detriment of the La Follettes.
Wasn't it because he was urging to stay out of the war?
Yes, I think so.
I believe that.
I'm sure that's pretty much
the whole family.
Yes, that was it. He was regarded as a pacifist.
Yeah. And a pacifist in those days must have been almost as bad as being a German.
Oh, yes. In fact, it... was dreadful because a family on University Heights suffered very much. Mr. Buell's daughter married, and her young husband did not sign up, didn't volunteer. And there was a great deal of hard feeling on the Heights. A great deal.
Why didn't he sign up?
Because Mr. Buell said that he'd married his daughter and he'd have to take care of her.
So you were expected as a young man to sign up?
Yes, you were expected to.
And go to war. That must have certainly changed the face of the campus.
Yes.
Were you around?
It caused a permanent disagreement between Professor McGilvery's, between the McGilvery family and the Buell family. Because Mrs. McGilvery went over to the Buells and accused the young man of being a slacker.
She actually went up and told him that?
Yes.
Oh my.
They didn't speak to each other for years.
Oh my.
And you know, in a small neighborhood, that's serious.
Yeah.
Does this go on?
Yeah, we're putting it on. Let me turn off.
Pauline Buell, the oldest of Mr. Buell's four daughters, married Carol Sweet. And when this occurred, Carol and Pauline left not only Madison, but went to India. He was with the Forest Products Laboratory. And they had a child born there. The child never was normal in any way at all, either physically or mentally. Then they had a second child who was normal. They came back and they eventually bought and built on the Buell's land sloping down from the house and built a little house on Pauline's father's land and lived there for many years. But they, I don't think, ever really lived that down. You know, that's a dreadful thing to do to a family.
Well, that's really, so emotions were really...
Very high during the war.
during the war, we're all familiar with the flu epidemic.
That was terrible.
Were you around Madison at the time?
Yes, and University Club was turned into a hospital.
Right. What was it like during that
pandemic? Well, it was a very serious thing, of course, and both of my mathematics professors from high school were killed in the First World War. And Dr. Middleton, who later became dean of the medical school, was a friend of ours. And when he went, he signed up with the AEF, it was called, American Expeditionary Forces. Went to France, and I knit him a scarf and sent it to him. And he said, I had that letter for years, and I don't know where it is now, that he wrote from the trenches, thanking me for it, saying it was long enough to wrap around three of them.
A very welcome gift, I'm sure.
Yes.
Did they use any anything besides the university club for... wasn't the Red Gym used as a hospital for a while?
I don't know. I didn't know it was. But it was a dreadful thing. It swept the country, not just Madison.
Now, we had soldiers coming in during World War One who were stationed here, too, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's get back to the list here. Beatty.
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 He was an English professor, and his field was the ballad.
And that was what he...
That was his specialty. He taught the English ballads.
And that was, in those times, that was enough to draw full classes?
Oh, yes. You had your specialties. Yeah.
Where would he have studied to study the ballad? Would he have gone to England to study
I don't know. He had a son, Hamilton Beatty, who became an architect, and he was a member of the University Heights Poetry Club. Oh, I haven't told you anything about that.
The son was?
No. No, Professor Beatty himself.
Well, let's talk about that since we're on Beatty. What about the Poetry Club?
Oh, the University Heights Poetry Club was founded by my father and Professor Charles Forster Smith, who lived next door to us. And they met every Saturday night and took turns in people's homes, and there was a leader. And they would decide at the beginning of the season what poet they were going to concentrate on. And they would read aloud, and then they always had ice cream and sponge cake.
Were these essentially members of the university?
Oh, yes, they were University Heights. There was my father and mother, the Professor Charles Forster Smith, Louis Kahlenberg, and his wife. Mr. Kahlenberg had about as much interest in poetry as I have in outer space. But it was neighborhood. the Ely's, Richard T. Ely, the Buells, the Maurers, Professor and Mrs. Flint, who did not live on University Heights, but he was a university astronomer. Now that, I don't mean professor of astronomy. He was the university astronomer. And they lived on a house on the corner of Charter Street and what is the street back of the old hospital?
Lorch or something. There are a couple of them. Well, the long one.
Yes.
Oh.
The one that...
I don't know. I'm blanking.
Anyways, yeah, they lived on that corner.
Okay.
And she came from Jamaica Plain, suburb of Boston, Massachusetts. And he came from Salem, Massachusetts.
I might mention... people who may not be familiar with some of these names, these are by no means English or LNS only.
Oh,
Maurer
no.
was an engineering professor.
Yes, he was engineering.
An astronomer, so.
And the Hilliers were chemistry.
And Kahlenberg was.
And Kahlenberg was chemistry.
So we have a rather diverse group studying poetry.
Yes. And some of them... it was essentially a neighborhood affair, and it lasted for years and years and years. And when I retired from teaching, they were having hard going. They had enlisted some people to keep it going, which people who really didn't want to join. There is a time when there's a time to quit, and they should have quit before they did. They invited me and urged me to join And I said, no, I said, I I don't think it's, I think the time has come to stop.
What were the heyday years of this club? When was it at its
probably peak? Around 1910.
And when did it start to?
It started to go down the hill. They went on for years, you know. It should have, when I came back to Madison to live.
1932.
And when I retired from teaching in 1963, it was really on shaky ground then, and it should have stopped then, but it didn't. They went on until, I think, the 70s or...
When did you refuse to join or decline their invitation to join?
What did I do?
When did you refuse?
Oh, 1963. They wanted me to, and I told them I thought that since I had led a life so regimented, I wanted really to enjoy my freedom and not have to belong to anything until I decided what. Newspaper clipping.
Okay, we're back on now. Were there any other neighborhood clubs like the University Heights Poetry Club that you can think of?
There was, yes, the Sewing Club, which was the wives of the professors of University Heights.
The wives of professors were the ones who were...
Yes. And, those were essentially those seven families.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do? How did that
They
happen?
Met and... brought their sewing, and they had ice cream and sponge cake.
So sponge cake was really the University Heights.
Yes, so, sponge cake.
What about within the university itself? Did you know of any dining clubs, or were you...
They didn't call them their dining clubs. They called the Town and Gown Club, of course, mm-hmm. and the Madison Literary Club.
Were you involved in any of those persons?
No, I was not. This was men.
This was men. These were men only?
Yes, they were.
Did women...
Women, you see, stayed at home in those days and took care of their children.
Did you ever hear resentment from women that no. they belonged to these
no,
organizations?
No, there was no resentment.
So it was just sort of a fact of life.
It was just a fact of life. It's the way women stayed home. The only Mrs. Buell, though, was the first one... And it was very much talked about when she became president of the Madison Women's Club.
Why did it become talked about that she became... The question is, why was it such an issue that she would be president of a women's club?
Because Mrs. Buell was the first person ever to do anything besides stay at home.
Oh, so the women's club was new.
Well, the women's club was fairly new in Madison. It was the Madison Women's Club.
What were people saying about that when she did that?
They didn't look at it completely with favor. They thought she belonged to taking care of her four daughters.
Now, did men and women feel the same about that, or were there
differences? Oh, the men had nothing to say. It was a talk among the women.
I see.
They couldn't understand how, when she had four small daughters, how she had the time to be president of the Women's Club.
Uh-huh. Now, we had some very prominent women's professors on campus, such as Helen C. White.
Yes. Madge Glicksman.
Yes.
Madge Pryor, she was. Yeah. Of course, Thornbury. We had the medical school had some very prominent women doctors. Mm-hmm. Dr. Washburn, Nettie Washburn, Marie Carnes, who lived together on Lake Mendota Drive in a beautiful house just by what we used to call the Rustic Bridge. That's Nettie Washburn, Marie Carnes, Dr. Thornton, Madeline Thornton in gynecology, who came and was brought here by Dr. Harris. He wouldn't come unless he could bring her. Hmm. And Maxine Bennett, a throat specialist in the university, and she and Dr. Prouty lived together. And no one ever mentioned the name of lesbian situations.
That just wasn't an issue at all.
I mean, it wasn't even talked about. But there's obviously is what it was.
With the doctors you're talking about?
Yes.
Oh, okay. did people understand that and just not say anything, or did they just not know or care?
I think they knew it and accepted it and didn't talk about it.
What about women, like several of the women you mentioned, Helen, let's go back to Helen C. White for a moment, because she's the one person I know more about.
Yes.
How did men feel about having women on the faculty?
Well, women were not paid as they should have been.
Okay.
Madge Pryor, who later married Harry Glicksman, never received what she should have received in salary. Women were not given their rights.
So they may have been accepted by the men, but they weren't paid.
But they were not paid properly. They were not paid equally.
Did you hear?
Madge Pryor talked about it all the time.
What did she say?
It was great resentment, of course.
Did she try to do anything about it?
Well, if she did, she didn't get anywhere.
So that was just another fact of life, but it was not a fact of life that people like Madge Pryor were pleased with by any means.
Oh, they weren't pleased at all, no. Not at all. Well, we'll talk about this other later, because this isn't along that issue.
What about, why were there so many women in the medical school?
I don't know.
As opposed to other...
I don't know. The medical school was headed, of course, by Dr. Middleton. Yeah. He was a dean. He came from Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, and brought with him, well, he followed, in fact, Dr. Evans, Joseph S. Evans came first, and brought with him Dr. Middleton and later Dr. Van Valsa, those two. And they all were from University of Pennsylvania, those three.
Oh, so that was sort of the channel was
yes.
Pennsylvania.
And, you know, people accepted things in those days, but they didn't talk so much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's an awful lot of talk about it.
So back then you...
I mean, lesbian, if a person was a lesbian, it existed, but it just wasn't subject of conversation.
Was it sort of considered their business?
Probably.
Yeah. I don't want to put words in your mouth or anything.
I think so.
So there weren't any petitions going around departments saying we've got to get rid of
because
she's a lesbian.
Oh no.
There's any of that kind of stuff.
There's nothing of that sort.
Oh, any kind of active discrimination aside from the
the low pay
was across the board, whether you were a lesbian or not.
Yes.
That wasn't any difference.
Of course, Dr. Washburn didn't care because she was the Washburn Flower family and had lots of money of her own.
While we're talking about minority groups like lesbians, what about gay men? Was that ever an issue on campus in the early days?
Burdette Kinney was one, and he lived at the University Club, and he went everywhere and was accepted just as like everybody else. People knew it, and that was it.
So you didn't see it hindering his career.
It didn't hinder his career. He lived down at the University Club for years.
What about black people? Were there many of those in Madison early on?
Not in the faculty.
I don't think so.
No.
What about in the student body?
Well, I don't believe there were many of them.
So discrimination against blacks was not an issue?
No, it was no issue. There was no issue because there were none.
What about Jews on campus?
Well, some of our most talented and gifted faculty people were Jews.
Were you aware of any?
Oh, yes. Professor Jastrow was one of the most talented and gifted people in the university faculty.
Did you know any?
Joseph Jastrow lived on Langdon Street.
He was an education professor, wasn't he?
I don't think so.
What was he?
I don't think he was an education.
I'll have to look him up for you, because he is a prominent person.
Oh, yes, and so was Dr. Prokosh, and I can't tell you what field he was in. Leonard Bloomfield.
Did you sense any kind of discrimination against?
Not the slightest.
And you never heard any of them?
Never. There was never any talk. Not the slightest.
Okay, well, that's,
I don't think that became an issue. It was not the issue. There was no discussion or talk about it in the early days of this university.
Okay, that's true. So the discrimination that existed, if I can summarize, and you can certainly correct me if I'm error here, the discrimination that existed in these early years was against women's pay, per se,
yes,
and against the German department during World War
I. Yes.
And against the pacifistic attitudes of La Follette,
yes,
and
yes,
Buell, and perhaps,
yes,
some others who might have...
But I would say the climate of this university was marvelous.
Okay.
I think it was a great university. I think it was the golden age.
You're not alone in that opinion, let me tell you. There are a lot of people who think the early years of 20th century, 1890...
Life was... wonderful thing. Professors weren't paid much of anything, but they loved their jobs.
I'm writing down more questions here as we go along. Let's get back to the list for a few moments, though. Comstock.
Dean Comstock was dean of the graduate school, I think, at one time. He was professor of astronomy. He lived in the house up there by the observatory.
By Washburn Observatory.
Yes. He had one daughter, Mary, who was a friend of my older sister's. And the Comstocks lived under themselves. They had lots of money. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it came from, but they had it. And Mary Comstock had a pony and a cart and went... with the pony pulled her in the cart. Such elegance didn't exist anywhere else in Madison.
That's not something you and your family had the
we didn't have any pony cart.
So that was sort of an upper class, or not upper class, but an activity that's
they were sort of by themselves. But he was very highly thought of, Professor Comstock.
Did you ever have use to go up there and use that telescope?
Years and years ago, we used to go up.
I've heard tell that.
It was open, I think, Wednesday nights, either once a month or to the public or something like that. But Professor Flint endeared himself. He was the astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what actually were his duties, I don't know.
Okay.
But he was the one from Salem, Massachusetts.
I've heard tell that telescope setup we have there was at one time one of the finest in the country.
Is it in use?
I think it's still used a little bit, but I guess it's not as effective because there's so many lights around here.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ones in New Mexico.
You see, you can't see the stars,
yeah,
either, because you used to be able to see the stars at night because the outdoors was dark.
The Milky Way is something you see in pictures now.
Yes.
Cunliffe.
Professor Cunliffe, all I can tell you is that he was in the English department when my father came here.
Did your father have any relations with him in any...
Oh, pleasant, but that's all I know.
A very famous name in UW history, John R. Commons.
Oh, yes, John R. Commons. John R. Commons lived out in the hinterland, out way, way out in what was then way out, and he was a very famous man in economics.
What's considered the hinterlands? Where would that be now?
It would be, you know where the old Middleton Road is?
Yeah.
around in where the old and new meet.
Yeah.
Around there.
Okay. Now that is out there pretty much.
Yes.
It's in the Crestwood area.
Yes.
Neil Dodge.
Neil Dodge was, his field was Milton. Great scholar, Milton scholar.
Another English professor.
Yes, he was in the English department when Father came here.
Did your father, did he entertain these people at his house much, or did he go to their house?
No, they didn't, people didn't entertain, except the poetry club. Mm-hmm. They, or if they, as one would talk about entertaining now, they were too busy looking after their children.
Yeah. So you had your supper parties of today were not things that generally occurred back then.
But people stayed home. They looked after their families. Yeah. We had a live-in maid, as you will read when I give you that, mm-hmm. who got $3 a week.
And room and board.
Yes. $3 a week.
And did she get evenings off, any evenings
Yeah,
off?
She got one Thursday afternoon off, after the noon meal, and Sunday, after the noon Sunday dinner.
And what were her responsibilities, essentially?
Everything.
She washed, she cleaned?
She did everything, but of course in our family you had to have more help than that if you've got five children. Mm-hmm. She did the cooking. She did everything that she was busy all the time.
Did she do any actually nanny type work or?
I don't think so.
Okay, so it was mainly just the keeping the house running.
Keeping the house going. The cooking, the washing, the ironing, the cleaning.
Did you have any one particular person who stayed out?
Yes, we had Thea, who stayed with us for years. She was a Norwegian girl.
Okay, what can you remember about her?
Oh, she was very sweet. Then we had a lovely one by the name of Astrid. And she was, mother found her crying in the kitchen one day and said, "Well, Astrid, what's the matter? What's the trouble?" And she said, "It's an awful nice place for me, but it's too nice for me."
Oh, my. Did she leave at that point?
No, mother comforted her and she stayed.
Why did she say it was too nice?
She hadn't been treated well before.
Oh.
She wasn't used to it.
Oh, that's very interesting. And it was not uncommon in those days for someone to have a maid.
Oh, everybody had them.
Dresden was the next one.
Arnold Dresden was professor of mathematics. And I am practically sure, I think he was Jewish. Some of our best people in the faculty were. He lived on Vilas Avenue, right, almost the second house from the corner of Edgewood, where Edgewood and Vilas meet. He was, I think Arnold Dresden was actually, came from Germany, I'm not sure. Professor of mathematics.
Professor Ely.
Yes, Richard T. Ely.
Of whom I saw the wonderful photo earlier.
Yes, Richard T. Ely came from Johns Hopkins. He was totally dependent upon his wife. And when he would go off anywhere, I remember his coming down the stairs and calling back and saying, "Anna, do I know where my shirts are in the valise?"
Was he kind of known for his absent mind? Was he absent-minded generally, or?
I wouldn't say absent-minded. He was totally dependent.
Totally dependent. Okay.
He had
that's a difference.
On his wife.
Mm-hmm.
His secretary lived in the house. One was Miss Bodman, Charlotte Bodman, who later married a Jew, Lyserson, and Miss Ryder was another secretary who followed, and the Elys had a son, Richard. First son came Richard, who was my brother Philip's age and friend. Then came John, who was a source of great sorrow to the Elys always. Richard T. Ely, in his mature and declining years, spent thousands of dollars getting John out of trouble, one thing after another. Then came Anna, who was my age and my friend. She was a year older than I. And Anna married Ed Morehouse, who also came with Micklejohn out here.
I don't know much about Morehouse.
Well, there isn't much. He didn't stay here long. He was a friend of the La Follettes, and when Phil La Follett was no longer governor, Ed, who was at that time in the Public Service Commission, realized his time would be up. And also Anna, his wife, they should never have married because she was in love with somebody else. He became very important in utilities, in the field of public utilities in the East. Very important job, and he had a lot to do with the Three Mile Island, you know that.
Yeah, the whole
thing in Pennsylvania.
The power plant.
Yeah, power plant. Huh. And then he became an alcoholic. He's had a sad life.
Now, you said the secretary, that Ely had a secretary. Did any other professors have secretaries?
No.
Did he pay for the secretary himself?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know whether he did or not.
Your but father, did he have access to a secretary at the university?
Who?
Your father.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Dr. Ely was the only person on University Heights, the only faculty man who had a secretary.
Mm-hmm. And she was a living, so that's...
And she lived in the house. I got a wonderful picture of the Heights girls and with Miss Bodman in the background.
We have Dr. Evans down next.
Joseph S. Evans.
He preceded Middleton.
Yes, he really was the founder of the man who established and gave the birth of the Wisconsin General Hospital. Mm-hmm. He came from Chester, Pennsylvania. And I tell you, there was no man that has ever come to this university in my lifetime who was more loved than Dr. Evans. People were crazy over him, especially the women. Oh, Mrs. McGilvery said, if Joe Evans told me to jump in the lake, I'd do it.
What was it about Dr. Evans that
his personality had charm. Also, he was a very good doctor.
And he worked his way up here to dean.
He wasn't dean, ever. Dr. Middleton became the dean. He brought Dr. Middleton later on. But Dr. Evans came first.
How long did Evans stay? Did he stay till?
He stayed till he died.
Till he died, okay.
Mm-hmm. And an interesting item, some years ago, in the newspaper, there was published a list of unclaimed estates, money.
Mm-hmm.
His name was there.
Oh, really?
I called the dean, I called the medical school, and I said, as long as this has never been claimed and there is money left by Dr. Middleton, I think the university should have it. Whether they ever did anything about it or not, I don't know.
Didn't he have any heirs?
He and his wife, who she was an alcoholic, adopted a daughter. And she turned out badly. It wasn't a fortunate affair.
Okay, we continue to, a little hard to read here, Shilar Erasker?
What?
Erask, E-R-A-S-K-E-S, Erascus?
What?
I can't, it's crossed out. I'm turning this
Eister, is it? English Eister? E-Y-S-T-E-R?
No.
No, okay. Skip it.
Fisk?
Oh, Fisk was in classics, and that's all I can tell you.
Okay.
But I understand from current classicists and that he was the real great scholar that the classics department has had here. Fisk.
And he was in the same, okay.
F-I-S-K-E.
Right. Giese? G-I-E-S-E?
Oh, Professor Giese.
Giese.
I have the most wonderful picture of him. He was a great friend of my father, Frederick William Giese. His mother was Norwegian, his father was German. He came here from Harvard and was not married. He struck up a great friendship with my father, and they were friends always until my father died. He was professor of French. He had two beautiful daughters and a son. Catherine Giese, he married, you've heard of the Marshall and Ilsley Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he married one of the Ilsley women. Mrs. Giese and Professor Giese were unbelievable. Their relationship was totally friendly, but one of the queerest I've ever heard of. She decided that she didn't want to live in Madison. She wanted to live in Switzerland. And so she went to Switzerland, and he, who was such a great scholar, was given by the university the privilege of teaching 2 years, and every third year he had off, and he went and lived with her in Switzerland.
Yes.
The third year.
Oh.
Well, they had these two beautiful daughters. Catherine was not interested in being a scholar, and went and lived with her mother in Switzerland. Rachel stayed and lived with her father. She was his right-hand person, and her tastes were his, and she was a great scholar herself. She could speak 6 or 7 languages. He was she got her schooling from him.
Hmm.
Irving, Professor Giese always thought Irving was stupid. Well, Irving was not stupid.
Irving's the son.
Yes,
okay.
Irving wasn't stupid at all. He just wasn't interested in books. After all, that doesn't mean you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
He built boats for people, and they sold them, and people used them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't build a boat if you're pretty stupid.
No, I guess not.
I have a wonderful picture, Professor Giese.
Whatever happened to the family? Did the Rachel stay?
Catherine still. I sent me a message from Switzerland via Mrs. Stanowitz, who is at Methodist retirement home. Rachel became chairman of the French department in Vancouver, University of British Columbia. At the outbreak of the Second World War, Professor Giese had died a few months before. When he retired, they went to live in California. And Rachel, who had been her father's absolute closest companion and associate, joined the WACS and saw active service in North Africa. I suppose as interpreter, because she had this great...
I'm sure, that was her handy thing to have among
and
the forces.
She has died. Then when she came back, and after the war, she had her appointment in British Columbia.
Whatever happened to the boat builder, Irving?
Well, he's living with Catherine in Switzerland.
Well, when the two daughters... separated, one staying here and one going to Switzerland. Did Irving stay here then?
No, Irving went with his mother.
Very interesting story.
And the family lived, have you ever heard of the University Tent Colony?
Oh, yes.
Well, they lived out there in the summers.
Oh, they did?
Yes. And Professor Giza and Rachel lived in our, had the third floor of our house for a year.
Now, they had a house here. Why did they choose the Tent Colony?
I don't know.
You were going to tell me where they lived.
They built the house on the corner of Summit and Lathrop Street. The southwest corner. There's a stucco house there, if it's still there, and I think it is. And they built that house, and do you know, for a year the bathtub stood out on the lawn?
That's a very interesting account of the Jesus. By the way, this tape is going to end, and this interview is going to end pretty soon, because we decided we're going to go an hour today.
I want to show you, Professor. Pleasure, but he didn't see it in actual print because he died. He translated into English prose one of the great French writers, Baudelaire.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Was it the first translation?
I think so, and I have a copy of it upstairs.
Well, that's fair.
Which I'll show you sometime.
Well,
The
next name on the list is Gauss.
John Gauss. G-A-U-S.
Gauss, right.
But it's pronounced Gauss.
Gauss.
John Gauss came here. I don't know whether he came. I don't think he came with Micheljohn. But anyway, he was here in political science. He later went to Harvard. He was extremely able. Jane Gauss was a member of our Friday lunch group. And have you heard of the essayist Edmund Wilson ever New York?
Right.
Well, John Gauss was named executor of, he was the one who was in charge of the papers of Edmund Wilson after he left here. But John Gauss, I think he came from, I'm not sure about whether he came from Amherst or